From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Madeleine Albright was the first woman to hold the position of Secretary of State of the United States. She became known for her advocacy for peace in the Middle East and bringing war criminals to justice. Today, she's the chair of the Albright Stonebridge Group, a global strategy firm. She's also written a memoir called Prague Winter, a personal story of remembrance and war, 1937 to 1948. The book chronicles her traumatic early life in Prague during the Nazi occupation, through the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. Albright spoke about the book at Seattle's Town Hall on February 23, 2013. The talk was moderated by Eric Liu, a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton.
It wasn't too long ago that I was coming back from China, and Chicago was the first port of entry, and I was there getting undressed for the security people, and I put my stuff down on the conveyor belt, and this lady behind me said, "So where'd you get all those screw-top bottles? My bottles all leak." And I said, "Well, I got them at the container store." And then I was going through the magnetometer, and the TSA guard looked at me and said, "Oh, my God, it's you." He said, "I'm from Bosnia, and we all love you in Bosnia, and if it weren't for you, there wouldn't be a Bosnia, and you're always invited in Bosnia, and can I have my picture taken with you?" So we stopped the whole line. I have my picture taken. I go back to get my stuff, and the lady of the screw-top bottle says, "So what exactly happened here?" And I said, "Well, I used to be Secretary of State," and she said, "Of Bosnia?" So...
Well, no, we're delighted to have the former Secretary of State of the United States here with us today. Although I will note, after you left the Clinton administration, there was some talk of you perhaps entering Czech politics and serving there. And so the idea of you just being a roaming Secretary of State for whatever country may need your services actually sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again to Dan, to Town Hall, to the Seattle Public Library Foundation for making this possible. And thanks to all of you for coming out on a rare thing, which is a sunny February Saturday in Seattle. This is really a great thing. And we are going to have a conversation that begins with the book, Prague Winter, that Secretary Albright, I think, will be able to sign after we're done here. But I think the conversation that we'll have, and then as we take questions from all of you gathered here, will range widely to many other topics. But I really did want to begin with this book. For those of you who haven't had a chance yet to read or see Prague Winter, it's a remarkable piece of writing. It both tells a story of history, which I think is undertold, of the pre-war years and the years right after World War II as the Cold War came on, from the vantage point of Czechoslovakia, from the vantage point not of the United States or not even of, in some omniscient way, allies versus Axis, but just what it was like diplomatically, politically, and personally to be there and watching these things unfold at this time. And Secretary, the first question I just want to put to you as you think about all the stories you wove into this book is why it is that you felt compelled to create a work like this that is partly memoir, but really in great proportion a work of history and in a sense, moral philosophy.
Eric, it's great to be with you. We worked together for a great president, and it's wonderful to be here with you in this beautiful place. So thank you. I decided this book was really written kind of in three layers. The inner layer is my family story. My father was a Czechoslovak diplomat and part of the first generation of Czechoslovaks. The country had been started in 1918, and they were my parents, my father as the diplomat, and then also my personal story, which was that I was raised a Catholic, married an Episcopalian, and found out I was Jewish. So I had to put that story together. Then
you could just start a joke saying you walk into a bar.
Right. I could. New line. Oh, we are going to have a good time. And then the second layer really is, as you pointed out, World War II from the perspective of a small country and trying to figure out how it fit in, governments in exile, how they dealt with basically being victims. What happened at Munich, which is the major agreement, was that the British and French made a deal over the heads of the Czechoslovaks. They never went to the meeting with the Germans and Italians, and Czechoslovakia was dismembered and sold down the river. And so the effects of how that worked. And then the third layer is actually probably the most difficult one, because I talk about how hard it is to make moral decisions. We have a feeling that things are black and white, but mostly things are gray, and there are issues of trade-offs, and trying to figure out how you, one, would behave under those kinds of circumstances. And I thought that it would be a good way to kind of weave those three, they're not distinct layers, but how to weave them together, because I think one informs the other.
For you, when you thought about first sitting down to create this book, was any one of those three stories the one that was most catalytic for you, that you felt you needed to get out?
Well, I think I did need to get out the inner story, and let me just say how that all came about. When I became ambassador of the United Nations, was the first time I really became a public figure. And what happened, there were all kinds of profiles and things about me. And so what happened, I started getting letters from people from the Czech Republic, and people would say, I'm a relative, send money, or I need a visa. But then among them, there were letters that had only partial facts in them, or the dates were wrong, the names were wrong. Somebody said they'd gone to school with my high school with my father in 1915, which would have been impossible. He was born in 1909. So then I tried to figure out what this was all about, because a couple of them would say something like, your family was Jewish. But since the rest of the facts never tracked, I didn't understand it. So in November 96, just as my name came up to be Secretary of State, I got a letter from somebody that had all the names and dates right, and the villages and all that, and they said, and we knew my family, knew your family, and you were a fine Jewish family. So it was just at the time that I was being vetted to be Secretary of State, and I was with the White House counsel, and they asked me the normal questions, like, had I paid my taxes, did I have a nanny,
in the Constitution.
Right. And then they said, we asked this question of everybody. Is there anything about you that we should have asked that you might want to tell us? And I said, well, I just got this letter, and it seems that I'm of Jewish background. And they said, so what? The president is not anti-Semitic. So over the holidays, I was with my daughters and their husbands, and we talked about all this. And they loved my parents. And so they thought, added to an already interesting background, this was an additional fact that they just found fascinating. So then, as you know, you're not allowed to talk to the press between the time that you're named and you get confirmation. And there was a reporter from the Washington Post who wanted to do a profile of me. And so my office gave him names of people. And on the first week that I was Secretary of State, he walks into my office and starts putting these disgusting documents in front of me. The Nazis were very organized, and they had cards that indicated whenever they had sent somebody to a concentration camp. And I'm looking at them with my family names, and there's no even word to describe how I felt, appalled, stunned, overwhelmed by it. And I had to try to figure out what had happened. Now, it may seem odd to people, but I had to prove that a woman could be Secretary of State. I couldn't leave, I had to work. So I asked my brother and sister to go to the Czech Republic to begin to put the story together, and they began to do that. The long answer to your question is I thought that not enough work had been done on that, and so I went back and I began to do much more research. Also, there was an institute in the Czech Republic for the study of totalitarianism, and they had all the secret police records. So they gave me my father's secret police records from the post-communist, or the communist time. And the allegation against him constantly was that he was a pro-Western Democrat. So I looked through that. They gave me his personnel files at the Foreign Ministry. But I wanted to put that part of the story together, and then that motivated me to see how it fit into the historical period of how they behaved as these young, new Czechoslovaks, and then during World War II.
You note in the book, in 41, I believe, your parents got baptized and joined the church in a formal way, and you reflect in the pages of the book about what must have been going through their minds as the pressures of the war, as the anti-Semitism, as the Holocaust began to enter onto the consciousness of people in Europe and around the world, and how difficult it would have been once the horrors of the Holocaust became known for them to really discuss the full complexity of the decisions that they were making about identity and what to mask and what to show and how to protect and so forth. For you, it's just a couple of paragraphs in the book, but I imagine it was a lot of soul-searching or stepping into the shoes of your parents about the choices they had to make in terms of their own identity.
Absolutely, and I think that, which is why I thought it was important to put it within the historical context. First of all, I now know that Czechoslovak Jews, for a great part, were quite secular Jews in many different ways. Prague was a place of very intellectual Jewish community, Franz Kafka, a variety of people. And then I also found among my parents' things, or in these papers, their wedding certificate. And under religion, they had something that you don't do in the U.S., but in Czech it was bezvyznání, which means without confession. So it isn't that they were atheists. They actually did not think of themselves as being of any particular religion. And they really, I knew them well enough to know that they thought about themselves as Czechoslovaks. I remember asking my parents, was I a Czech or a Slovak? And they said Czechoslovak. And they had come out of that generation of that new country. They were dead by the time all this came out, and partially, and I have to say, I had the strangest collection of feelings in January 97. It was amazing to be named the first woman Secretary of State in a country where I had not been born. I'm a naturalized citizen. I couldn't believe it. I never thought it would. You know, a lot of people thought that I always wanted to be Secretary of State. It had never occurred to me. And I was just stunned, and it was an amazing feeling. And then, as you see people now at the State of the Union when they say, Mr. President, the cabinet, and it was the first time in history that a woman had led the cabinet down the aisle. And at the same time, I had been accused of lying about my background, and I didn't understand what had happened. I couldn't figure out what had happened, what my parents had thought. I had also been accused of being stupid for not having asked any questions. So I think that all those things came together, and so in this chapter, I did try to speculate about what had made them do it. So 1941, I said, it couldn't have been to get away from the Holocaust because we were already out in England. This happened in England. This is very self-centered, but I think that most of what they did was to protect me and then have my brother and sister later. And in terms of just thinking, it didn't take a lot of imagination to realize it might be easier to be raised a Christian than a Jew during the war. And then I did. Actually, I do, knowing them as I did, I cannot believe that they would have made that decision once they knew how many Jews had died. And so I was trying to figure out what their reasoning was. I don't know, really. I do know the following thing, is that when we came to the United States in 1948, we moved out to Denver and were there just a very small nuclear family. And I can see why they didn't tell us anything. I mean, we had going to have a new life. We were so grateful to be in America. And then why would they burden their children with this appalling horror in terms of their own lives? And the reason I didn't ask was there was nothing to ask about. I mean, I had my parents told me about their families and where they came from, and there was nothing missing in the story. And so that's the only explanation I can give.
One of the other layers of just moral complexity and choice-making that runs throughout the pages of Prague Winter is your depiction of your father's boss, Edvard Beneš, who was the leader of Czechoslovakia and the leader in exile of the government during much of the Second World War. And you muse as well in the pages of the book about key choices that he made, actions or omissions, from the time of Munich all the way through 48, when the communist takeover became solidified. And one of the most basic questions you ask there is about, you know, when Munich happened, when the other allied nations essentially, as you said, had gone over the head of the Czechoslovak people and cut this deal with Germany. There was a choice, I suppose, that Beneš had faced about whether to accept the terms of this deal, or as some, both in the military and the diplomatic corps of his country, were urging him to do, to fight, to resist this, even if it was going to be, in the end, a very costly, bloody, lost cause, right? And you write about the ways in which, boy, what would one do in that situation, right? It is very easy in hindsight, historically, to look at the circumstances of Munich and how one responded to it, but when you just for a moment put yourself in the shoes of someone like that, trying to make a decision for a people, and whether strategic retreat or drawing the line here was the right course, as you thought about that from the vantage point of having been in a similar role, having had to make choices and draw lines and decide things, how did you choose to tell that story? How did you choose to describe the moral choices that Beneš was facing?
He was in a very difficult position. He was the second president of Czechoslovakia, having followed a towering figure, a man called Thomas Garrigue Masaryk. And by the way, it was interesting, he was married to an American, Charlotte Garrigue, and he took her maiden name as his middle name. I don't know a lot of men that have done that recently. And this was at the sometime in the last quarter of the 19th century. And the Czechoslovak constitution was modeled on the American one with a significant exception in that it had equal rights language in it in 1918. And this Thomas Masaryk was one of these people. He looked like a president. He acted like a president. He had this great moral authority. And Edvard Beneš had been his foreign minister, and then he took over from this towering figure at a time where Czechoslovakia had really tied itself to the West. As I said, it really it was modeled on the United States, it came out of World War I, and so I think he depended a great deal on the West. And what happened was, and I understand this better now than I ever did, is I have always thought of Neville Chamberlain as one of the most odious figures of history, but I can understand a little bit more in terms of how tired the British and French were from World War I. They had lost a generation of young men, and they would have done anything to have peace. And nobody in their right mind could imagine the barbarism of Adolf Hitler, and so they felt that they could keep giving a little bit more, plus that they did not have a really developed military budget or a really infrastructure in that. They had lost so much in World War I. So Beneš is in this position of having this country where he was not asked his opinion about Munich at all, and Czechs did want to fight. They, in fact, mobilized, and they were ready to fight. And what I think he did was to take into consideration as to whether, if he fought, whether that would bring the British and French in to fight the Germans, and therefore, even though they would lose people, they weren't really sure it would motivate the West to fight, or if the situation was so bad that nobody cared. After all, Neville Chamberlain had said, "Why should we care about people in faraway places with unpronounceable names?" And so I think that he then made that decision that he could actually save the nation in the long run by not going to war, but he was very, very much criticized for it, and somebody that was kind of viewed as weak. And the Czechs had a very weird reputation anyway as a result of their lack of action during the First World War. They were part of Austria-Hungary, and there was this Czech character, a made-up person, the good soldier Schweik. He was this soldier who never fought, who basically sabotaged things, and so that was kind of the Czech myth. But I think he was very, very much criticized by people, frankly, to some extent also by my father, who had been one of the young people that had mobilized, but then was part of the government in exile in London. But it was a very hard decision, and to specifically to your question is, I think, again, things I never thought I would do, to actually either raise my hand at the UN or later in principals meetings to send people to war is a really, really much harder decision than anybody knows. I think people think that often decision makers are trigger happy. They are not. I don't care who they are. I think that it is a very, very hard decision to make.
Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State and the author of Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. Albright spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 23, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Madeleine Albright in a moment. 827, 94.9, KUOW. Peter Panashaway, the embattled minister and MP, steps down over election irregularities, but vows to run again. Also, a golf game ends dramatically when a Missouri resident disappears into a sinkhole. The Calgary Co-op will no longer sell pork or eggs from caged animals. And mathletes around the world celebrate Pi Day. It's all tonight at 11. The newly elected, formerly Argentine Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio is the first pope from the Americas, the first Jesuit pope, the first to choose the name Francis, and the first pope in the modern era to be elected after a papal resignation. A conversation about the challenges facing Pope Francis and the Catholic Church tonight at midnight. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows mid to upper 40s. Rain at times this evening, showers likely after midnight. Friday highs somewhere in the 50s, cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, showers likely in the afternoon. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows in the 40s, mostly cloudy chance of showers. Saturday highs around 50 degrees, cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, showers in the afternoon.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright had a tumultuous early life. She was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, in 1937, on the eve of the Nazi occupation. Her Jewish parents converted to Catholicism and were forced into exile in England. There, they endured the worst of the Blitz. Albright focuses on her childhood in her new memoir, Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 23, 2013. The talk was moderated by Eric Liu, a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. Liu speaks first.
One of the things that your exploration of Munich and Benedict's choices there is an example of throughout the book is you do a lot of counterfactuals. You do a lot of what-ifs and ask these what-ifs as a matter of history, also as a matter of just your own family history. And I'm curious what it is in your approach to things that feeds this curiosity about what if a certain thing had shifted differently, what if a certain leader had acted differently, what if a small circumstance had been different. Do you feel like this kind of tendency to ask that question was something that your parents had instilled in you, that the experience of being raised in this way during this time had instilled in you, or is it something that's been more recent?
I think it's a combination of things. I truly have had a completely accidental life. I was born, as everybody now, 1937, which makes me 75. I didn't know about the Jewish part until I was 59 years old, but I did know that there had been the possibility that my parents would have never left Czechoslovakia during World War II and what might have happened then, or then later that my parents would not have left when the communists took over. So then I never would have come to America. It never occurred to me that there might be a possibility. I wanted to make a difference and do interesting things, but it never occurred to me that I might end up where I have. And so there's a lot of what if in my own life. At the same time, I also am a professor, and counterfactual is one way to teach. And I also, to this day, I teach a course at Georgetown on, I say foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. So what is the toolbox that you have? And when I have my students write papers, which are not 35-page papers, because as you know, nobody in the government reads a 35-page paper, they're short memos, and I always make them do the counterargument. And it's part of the way that you present a case to the president, is to say, this is what you can do, these are the arguments against it. So I think I have a kind of what-if mentality, but it does allow you to analyze in an interesting way, and so there are a lot of what-ifs in the book.
One of the things you mentioned a moment ago, and the applause might have obscured it, is that your pride both in being the first woman to be Secretary of State, but also to have been a naturalized citizen and becoming Secretary of State. And this dimension of your identity and your work of having been naturalized and an American by choice in this way resonates throughout the book. You don't talk so much about America and the United States except toward the very end when your family, when your father is able to convert a post, a temporary post at the UN into asylum here in the United States. But I'm just wondering, as you think about all these threads of identity and history in Prague Winter, how it shapes your sense of what America is and what America means and what it is that we take for granted oftentimes about citizenship here in this country.
Well, first of all, let me just explain. We had gone to England during the war and then came to the U.S., and my father used to say this on a regular basis, which is we were in England and people would say to us, we're so sorry, your country's been taken over by a terrible dictator, you're welcome here, and when are you going home? When we came to the United States, people would say, we're so sorry that your country's been taken over by a terrible system, you're welcome here, and when will you become a citizen? And my father said that was the huge, in just two sentences, the difference in this country. So for me, people ask me what's the most important thing that ever happened to me. Hands down, it's becoming an American. There's no question in my mind about that. I did this a little bit more in my memoir, Madam Secretary, is kind of to make the point that America's international presence and involvement is kind of the key to everything. And so America was not present at Munich. It was a period when America was turned inward, dealing with various economic problems, and FDR was looking inward at that time too, and terrible things happened. Then what happened was the U.S. came into the war. I remember that. We were in London, and I remember that very well. American soldiers, and everything changed. Then at the end of the war, towards the end of the war, General Patton marched into Czechoslovakia 45 miles, and then as a result of agreements made during the war, he did not go further, and the Soviet Union liberated Czechoslovakia, and the wall came, Iron Curtain came down, and 50 years of communism. So in my life story, the presence of America has made all the difference, and the goodness of American influence and the goodness of American involvement. So that has been a theme. And so being a citizen, for me, is the crucial aspect of this country. And while it may sound self-serving, I do think immigrants actually help this country.
You will get no argument here. One of the things that is also, I think, very striking about Prague Winter is your reflections. They're reflections in the nature of philosophy of history, in a way, about the role of leadership and how one theory of history is that, you know, things happen in unpredictable, chaotic, complex ways, and tiny little sparks and actions that are unpredictable set things in motion. And another school of history is about the role of leaders and the catalytic role, either for good or for ill, of leaders. And I'm wondering if you could just speak a bit, both in the context of the war years and what stories you tell in this book, but also in the context of your career, about ways where you have felt that the presence of a given leader made a difference that led to outcomes that would not have otherwise happened if things had just been unfolding organically and left to themselves.
I'm very glad you asked that, and I am a professor, so I'll try not to take 50 minutes, but I actually teach a course where I talk about five factors that affect every country in the way that it makes foreign policy decisions. One is objective, where the country is, what are the facts, demographics. The other is subjective, how does a country feel about itself at any given time, post-Vietnam or whatever. The third is how the government is organized, in our case, executive-legislative relations. You can either make it work or have gridlock. The fourth is the executive, the bureaucratic politics that are reflected in our system by the way the budget comes out. And the fifth is the role of individuals. I really do think that the role of individuals is absolutely crucial. And I think we all reread books that we didn't understand in the first place. And one was War and Peace that I reread not long ago. I completely disagree with Tolstoy, who's a fatalist and doesn't believe in the role of individuals. But it made me realize how much I do, that the kind of leadership that can be at any level makes a huge difference in terms of how others react to you, what you think your sense of history is. So I have many examples, and Thomas Masaryk is obviously one of them. Václav Havel is another one, somebody who came out of a system and was able to lift the moral quality of his country. Nelson Mandela, somebody who's made more difference in his own country than anybody that one can think of. In my lifetime, my first American president was Harry Truman. We came to the United States in November 1948. He had just been elected in his own right, and kind of watching what he did in terms of understanding America's role in Europe, the Marshall Plan, the Point 4 program, really understanding what needed to be done. And then I do believe that I do think President Clinton made a huge difference in terms of issues that I worked on in terms of what we did in the Balkans and how we did it and why we did it. And I obviously believe that President Obama has. So I do think. Then there are those who have made a difference for evil. And Hitler is the clearest example of that. Stalin is another example of it. And then I still have the rather peculiar distinction of being the only high-level sitting American official to meet Kim Jong-il in North Korea. He made a terrible difference. So I do believe in both positive and negative aspects. And leadership may be for ill as well as for good, I think.
This list of factors that you were describing that you use when you're teaching your students about foreign policy and what animates a nation's actions, I want to focus in particular on what you were talking about, the way that the society organizes itself for self-government, and you allude in passing that it can either work for effective outcomes or yield gridlock. Dan Dixon, in his introduction, noted that the 99-0 confirmation vote that you experienced is, in the context of today's politics, a bit of fairy tale fantasy land. That it's just not so conceivable today in our politics that you might have that kind of unanimity on something. And we were talking before we came on stage here about the ways in which, even in the time since you served in the Clinton administration, our political culture here in the United States has shifted, where what happens in campaigns doesn't end anymore with a campaign, but that there is this permanence of campaign mindset and this permanence of the polarization that in presidential elections. And I'm wondering if you could say a bit from your perspective now, having been out of government a bit, but still active and engaged in the shaping of public life, about how things are going this way and what it's going to take for us, either as individual citizens or as a country, to get us back to the basics of self-government.
By the way, Jay Rockefeller was the missing vote, and he was trapped. Have we lost?
I think we lost your mic.
Well,
there we go.
Jay Rockefeller was the one that didn't vote for me, but he was traveling, so we've talked about that a lot.
And he's still apologizing.
He's still apologizing. The thing that I would also like to note is that I spent a great deal of time with Jesse Helms, who was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and we were able to get along and get things done. When I first went to see him, as I was getting confirmed, he said, "Ms. Madeline, we will make history together." And we managed to do an awful lot of things together so that it is possible and absolutely necessary. I so believe in elections. I have participated in many campaigns here. I'm chairman of the board of an organization called the National Democratic Institute that works on democracy issues abroad. So I believe in elections. But elections are necessary but not sufficient. And the question is, why do people get elected? They get elected in order to govern. And all we have done now is think about the election and how much money it takes, and then already thinking about the next election and then the election after that. And just when President Obama had that interview with Secretary Clinton, and he said, they were already asking about the next election. He said, "I just started 4 days into my second term." So I think we have become obsessed by the election process and not enough about what governing is about. And trying to figure out, for me, I happen to believe in government. I do think that I wish we actually had a debate about what government is for in the 21st century. And why do people come together in order to have a government? And I think we've forgotten that in some ways. And partially, we just also depend on watching these people argue all the time and do not take our role as citizens seriously enough in terms of voicing our views and not being stupefied by the media, which has to keep talking about elections because that they see it as a game. And so I do think that we need to rethink a little bit more about what happens between elections. And if people don't believe in government, why do they want to go and be elected to serve in the government?
Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State and the author of Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. Albright spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 23, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Madeleine Albright in a moment. 844 94.9 KUOW. North Korea recently threatened the United States, Japan, and South Korea with nuclear war following new United Nations sanctions. What should be made of these threats? Could North Korea strike the United States? We'll talk to Donald Hellman, a professor of political science and professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, about the politics of North Korea tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. In a program on the theme writing fiction versus writing nonfiction, William Gibson talks about his first collection of nonfiction, Distrust That Particular Flavor. Author John DeGatta and fact-checker Jim Fingal talk about the boundaries of literary nonfiction as chronicled in their book, The Lifespan of a Fact. Jonathan Lethem talks about his role as a novelist, which he explores in his book, The Ecstasy of Influence, Nonfictions, Etc. And Joan Didion talks about her book, Blue Nights, which explores her thoughts about children, illness, and growing old in the wake of the death of her daughter. All tomorrow evening at 9 o'clock. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows mid to upper 40s. Rain at times this evening, showers likely after midnight. Friday highs in the 50s, cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, showers likely in the afternoon. We have a news update. No, we don't. The news update will come after this next segment with Madeline Albright. I beg your pardon. However, I will tell you about the weather forecast for the Seattle area, which says lows tonight, mid to upper 40s, rain at times this evening, showers likely after midnight. Friday, highs somewhere in the 50s, cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, showers likely in the afternoon. A young woman and her mother talk about mother's habit of screening the men-daughter dates for character defects, and daughter resenting that, but grudgingly admiring her mother's perceptiveness because she's almost always right about these guys. Also, David Catling, professor of Earth and Space Science at the University of Washington, talks about the Mars rover Curiosity's discovery of chemical evidence of life and whether or not it brings us any closer to knowing if life ever existed on the red planet. And science journalist Emily Anthes talks about her book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. All three of these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Madeleine Albright was sworn in as U.S. Secretary of State in 1997, making her the first woman to hold that job, and the highest-ranking woman in the history of the U.S. government. During her tenure, Albright influenced American and the U.S. at the transfer of sovereignty over Hong Kong. Today, she's the chair of the Albright Stonebridge Group, a global strategy firm, and serves as the honorary chair of the World Justice Project. Her new book is called Prague Winter, and it's a memoir of her early life at the onset of World War II. She spoke about the book and politics at Seattle's Town Hall on February 23, 2013. The talk was moderated by Eric Liu, a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. Liu speaks first.
One of the things that this polarized permanent campaign environment creates is it massively disincentivizes elected leaders and people in public life from ever admitting error or failure or mistake or even ambiguity of judgment, right? And yet, a book like Prague Winter, a career like yours, is testament to the fact that in public affairs, whether you're talking in foreign policy or domestic policy, it's, as you said at the outset, it's all shades of gray, right? And it's all learning from either error or rethinking judgments that one had made earlier and readapting them to a different time. When you're teaching now, with your students at Georgetown and speaking at other places, what is the role for you of error, failure, missed opportunity in the way that you teach, either in talking about errors of your own or in talking about in the arc of history things that people could have done differently and could then learn from in order to not repeat the mistake?
I really do think it's important to make clear that not every decision you've made is perfect and that you have missed various opportunities and why. And I think that it's important to analyze how decisions are made. One of the things that's easy to do is to criticize in hindsight when, in fact, there are a lot of facts that come out that you didn't have before. And I'm always asked this particular question, why didn't we do something about Rwanda? And it is a very good example of something, which is that you need to understand the context within which a decision is made. And in that particular case, we were already had peacekeepers in Bosnia. What had happened in Somalia when Black Hawk went down and Americans were dragged through the streets. There were refugees coming from Haiti on the boats and riots going on. And people went, and President Clinton was very involved in trying to deal with the economy, stupid, and a variety of issues. And mainly what we didn't have was information about what was going on in Rwanda. There's been an awful lot since then, but in fact, at the time, there was not. And so the question is, you know, why didn't we do something? And I do think we learned, at least I try to talk about it in terms of understanding the context in which decisions are made and the importance of having information that you have at the time. And then do what we actually, President Clinton, well, you know this, kept saying, how did this happen? Why did this happen? Go through the TikTok with me in terms of where we made a mistake. I have any number of times apologized for things that I've done wrong. I think it's very important for people to understand that mistakes are made, that human beings make mistakes, and that the issues are not always as clear as they seem. And so analyzing decision-making, I think, is an essential part. I also do think that you need a certain amount of humility if you actually are going to be a leader. I wrote a book called Memo to the President-Elect at a time that I had no idea who the president was going to be. I ultimately did give it to Barack Obama, and I inscribed it with the audacity to hope that this book might be useful to you. But I had said that I wanted to have a confident president rather than a certain president. Because competence allows a leader to be able to listen to a lot of diverse ideas and then make up his or her mind. But you need the confidence not to feel kind of put off if, in fact, somebody says something that you don't agree with, versus a certain president who doesn't even know what he doesn't know. And so I think that there has to be that amount of humility.
I want to pick up on that confidence, and this is a very intuitive audience. You can fill in the blanks here. But I think one of the questions that I want to pose as well, I mean, in reflecting on your own, the faith dimensions of your own identity, you've also written other books about the role of faith in public life, particularly in foreign policy making and international affairs. And oftentimes that difference between confidence and certitude, a blinding certitude, can be, people can be moved from one to the other oftentimes by faith and by not just a religious-like belief in something, but an actual religious belief in the rightness of a course or the divine providence of a path. And for you, I'm wondering if you could describe today, as you look at the world, post-Arab Spring, you look at the way in which the United States is reckoning with all of these changes all around the world today, about the role of faith and how foreign policy gets made and how much American policymakers should be attending to the faiths of others, whether we should simply take it as a given that people in this country will believe with all their might in X, and so we must accede to that, or whether there's a work of persuasion or otherwise to get them off that belief.
Well, books I never thought I would write. One is that I did write a book about the role of God and religion in foreign policy, and it's called The Mighty and the Almighty. And what I thought about that is that we are a country that believes in the separation of church and state. Interestingly enough, initially that came about because the church didn't want the interference of the state rather than the other way around. But clearly, even though we believe in that, you cannot separate people from their faith. You have to know what it is. And my sense was that there was an awful lot more where various people's religions did play a role in the way that the foreign policy was carried out. So, and I also felt, I still do, that Americans don't understand enough about Islam. And I was the first secretary that put Muslim holidays on the official calendar. We also had iftar dinners, the kind that you do to break the feast, and tried to learn much more about Islam. We had, as we were leaving office, we were going to do a brochure about Islam, and then the next we didn't, and the next people didn't do that. And so I used a lot of that for the basis of this book. I think that more and more we can see, and you've come back to this a couple of times about identity. I find more and more interesting that as there is globalization, that people have a need to identify more closely with their own group, whatever it is, because globalization is so in large, and basically that people lose who they are. And so we have found more and more kind of ethnic groupings everywhere as a result of that. And I also think that they're just, that is also part of a greater identification with a religion. What I found in writing this book is that every one of the three Abrahamic religions has some pretty grim parts in their holy books. I think if you read the Old Testament, pretty grim. The New Testament also has swords and various fighting in it, and the Quran does too. But they also all have very similar language in terms of peace, love, charity, justice in a number of different ways. And I think we need to find more of those common aspects. I believe that a lot of what is going on now in terms of what's happening in the Arab world is actually a major division within Islam. I think most Americans didn't know a Sunni from a Shia, but I think we're beginning to understand that a little bit more, and the motivating factor of that, and that every one of the major religions can be hijacked by those who believe they're doing something on behalf of God, and that is a damaging aspect in terms of the way that we're operating with each other. But I do believe it's important to understand that identity and to respect it. I don't like the word tolerance, because tolerance means to tolerate, to put up with. I think what we need to do is have respect for people with other religions and understand what's motivating, and then understand how it is playing into other aspects of their national identity or the way that it's being used.
Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State and the author of Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. Albright spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 23, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at Seattle C.